This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Michael K. Williams had a breakout role on the HBO show The Wire. He played Omar Little, a Baltimore stick-up man. Omar was a really intense and rich character. He was menacing, he robbed drug dealers, he was gay, and he lived by his own strict moral code. Williams played him brilliantly. But when he was cast in the role, he wasn't in the best place personally. He was trying, though.
I put together this real gaudy package and a hit list of 10 people who I was going to send this package to, like the real, the headshot. My homeboy, his mom's worked for Tiffany's. So I went and got all these Tiffany pins and Tiffany boxes, and I sprayed the tissue with Tiffany cologne, just going all out. And I sent them out for Christmas presents, right? I said, you know what, Mike, it's Christmas. Let it marinate. I said, I watched my clock. It's right around January 10th, 14th. I should be getting some calls like, oh, my God, we want to see you. Man, here we are in March. Like, yeah, man, I kind of slipped into a darkness. I got a little depressed. That's where I was at when I got the call from Alexa Fogel. Thank God for her. She scoured the streets of New York to find me because apparently she did not see my awesome package.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Michael about what it felt like to be a club kid who got a real gig being a backup dancer.
I felt like it's really possible to get paid doing something you love. You know, that wasn't a job. That was my first glimpse into my career, you know. Who'd have thunk it? Me from Brooklyn, from Flatbush, with a career.
But first, I'll talk with the actor and comedian Zach Galifianakis. His character in the new FX series Baskets is a downtrodden rodeo clown, and he's pretty nasty. Zach will tell us why they made him that way.
There are people that are mean. Just go walk the streets. They're never represented. We're trying to represent people in this show that aren't represented on TV. We just aren't.
Plus, I'll play you a rap song about death that makes me want to live. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedian Andy Kindler once called Zach Galifianakis the thinking man's Pauly Shore. It's because Zach has always been deeply committed to dumb jokes, but he always finds a way to make the dumbness his own. Galifianakis, obviously, these days, well-known as a movie star, the one-man wolf pack of the Hangover movies, among other films. He's also the man behind Between Two Ferns, the very uncomfortable talk show deconstruction that boasts among its past guests the president. His new show, Baskets, on FX, is about a sad clown. And when I say a sad clown, I mean literally a sad clown named Chip Baskets, who fails out of French clown school because he doesn't speak French. He comes home to Bakersfield, and in this scene from the show, he's applying for the only clown job he can find at the rodeo.
It says here that you studied clowning at the Clown Frances, Académie de Clown Frances.
That's correct, at the Académie de Clown and Francois.
So, Chip Baskets? Oh, my God. What a name for a clown.
That's my real name. That's my...
Your Basket's a clown now, Pally.
I have another clown name, and I prefer to go by that, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, what's your clown name?
My clown name is Renoir.
What?
Renoir.
Can't have no clown here named Renoir. You're Basket's. Basket's a clown. You know how many of you clowns end up in a basket? That's the most perfect clown name I ever heard.
Great.
You're hired.
I am.
Sure. Don't take nothing to get hired around here other than walk in that door right there and tell me you're damn fool enough to want the job.
Thank you very much.
I don't pay enough.
Mm-hmm.
They all quit. You'll quit too.
I'll take it.
Okay. Care for a cup of coffee before you leave?
No, I'm okay. Thank you.
If I'm remembering correctly, that coffee cup is shaped like a toilet.
Jesse, take the high road. There's very little traffic on there. Yeah, there's a he's drinking from a coffee mug in the shape of a toilet.
So, one of the things that you've always loved doing, and it's kind of an interesting thing to be really into for a guy who made his name as a stand-up comic who mostly sat behind a piano, is just big, stupid pratfalls.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you conceived of this clown character partly because you just wanted to do things where you, like, ran into stuff and fell.
I would have done that regardless of whatever character, because it's really fun to do. No, the rodeo clown aspect just kind of came as kind of a weird juxtaposition in my head of a guy that was bitter in his mind and then where he had to, you know, externally be happy for his work made me laugh. But the physical comedy in it, yeah, just is, it's just something that I'm kind of obsessed with right now is physical comedy. And it's not very popular anymore. I think that's why I wanted to do it.
Well, I think everybody wants to do a movie that has a lot of improvised punchlines, which means you have to have a lot of kind of setups and you give a bunch of punchlines while you're in front of the camera. And you can't – it's very difficult to improvise a good fall because you have to not hurt yourself really badly.
My hips are they've been out of whack for a few months because of this show. And I don't do the heavy lifting. There's a gentleman named Hayden Dalton that does most of the heavy lifting. But sometimes for the camera, you just have to do it. But I'm too old. I'm too old to be doing it at my age.
How do you hire someone to fall down on your behalf? I mean, is it just a regular stuntman?
Well, you go on monster.com. Is that yes. The resume website?
No. Jobbing.com.
Well, first, the stunt person, it's all about your body type. And so if they are your body type, unfortunately for Hayden, he is my body type. So, you know, then with a show like this, because it's more specific, the physical humor is... is trying to be as straight-faced as possible while we're doing these kind of weird things. So with a stunt person, they come with a set of skills, but, you know, I don't like over-the-topness with it, even though it is over-the-top. I think the physicality should be as normal or as real as possible, given the circumstances. There's a pratfall coming up on an episode that I'm hoping to win a Pratty for.
What's been the most physically painful for you if you're actually hurting yourself here?
Just falling down. I mean, I do it anyway, even if I'm not being filmed. I do it constantly. So it's – I have to stop doing it is what I'm saying. I have to stop desperately, you know, looking for that cheap laugh.
Yeah, like let's be clear. When you say you're doing it anyway, you don't mean that you're like uncoordinated and oafish, and you would just trip and fall anyway. You mean that off camera for attention?
No, Matt, I think unfortunately it's both. I'm doing it, I'm coordinating it, and I'm trying to come up with pratfalls myself, but also they happen accidentally now. Because I've been doing so many pratfalls, it's weakened my body to give in to real pratfalls. If that makes sense. It's a vicious, vicious cycle.
The world is very cruel to Chip Baskets, the main character of Baskets. He is no peach himself. He's kind of a jerk to everyone around him, too.
Mm-hmm.
What did you like when you were putting together this show? Why did you think, I want to play a guy who's a jerk and also everything around him that happens is sad and awful? There's a lot of really good laughs on this show. Like, I want to be really clear about that when I'm saying that.
Right. No, I understand. And we made it hard on ourselves because you don't want to make him too milquetoast or whatever the word is or TV funny. I mean, I always see these TV shows with very fast-talking people and likable, you know, edgy, if you will, and you know, in a very watered-down version of life. There are people that are mean. Just go walk the streets. They're never represented. We're trying to represent people in this show that aren't represented on TV. They just aren't. Why can't we stretch out a little bit and at least explore these other avenues? Now, the problem with that, though, Jesse, is you kind of tend to write yourself into a corner. But I think
what's the corner that you write yourself into?
Well, without redemption or without growth of a character, and if he's just mean, you know, this is a serial structure, a serial narrative. So I want him to have growth. I want him to have redemption. I want him to, but I want him to struggle to find it. I want it to be awkward and clumsy and funny and insightful and heartbreaking as life is. The way that we are also used to TV shows being, I just find so normal and regular and not very creative. And I'm not saying that we have accomplished that whatsoever. I think I'm certainly aware of the fact that certain people are turned off by this show because of its weird structure and what its, you know, its aim is. But you can't just keep the character mean is what I'm trying to say. To answer your question, yes, he is. But I'm hoping to explain why he is. And I think he kind of represents our culture as being kind of angry and mad. And that was a tinge of it, too, in coming up with the character.
I mean, there's something to be said for a guy who, no matter what, genuinely believes in something. And it seems like Chip Baskett's pretense is sincere, not a pose, that he really wants to do something special, whether or not he has the, you know, the ability or the context, either one.
I mean, all I can do is, yes, agree with that. I mean, I think it's a pretty grounded show emotionally. And given that Chip is kind of this, where we're catching him in a spot in his life where he is this kind of prickly guy, doesn't mean that he's going to stay there. We're just meeting him right now. People are complex. And he's not going to be one note like that, I don't think. I hope. I mean, I don't know what to do with him, to be honest. I mean, they picked it up for a second series, and it's like, oh, God, they did? I mean, didn't they see the show?
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Zach Galifianakis, who co-created the new FX series, Baskets. Let's hear another clip from Baskets. So Chip Baskets has almost a sidekick, an insurance adjuster named Martha, who's played by Martha Kelly, very funny stand-up comic. In this scene, so the two of them meet when Chip crashes his scooter in one of Zach's patented hilarious pratfalls. And she just kind of hangs out with him, maybe because he has a vision for his life and she doesn't for hers. But she's been trying to tell him something for a while now, and we hear her telling him in this scene.
So, Chip, we have a really important thing we need to talk about.
First things first, okay? I'm no longer Renoir. I'm Baskets the Clown.
Okay. When were you Renoir?
What do you mean, when was I Renoir? I've always been Renoir. Now I'm Baskets.
Okay.
Another thing is that I think I can, you know, work on my brand. So I want to take an ad out in the yellow pages, but I want it to stand out. That's why I want it to be in the white pages. You're not going to write this down?
Sorry. Yellow page and the white pages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Chip, we need to talk about a sensitive matter.
Martha, if you start crying, I'm going to walk out of here and I'm going to take your car with me.
Okay, Chip, it's your scooter. It can't be fixed.
What?
I'm sorry.
Have you tried to repair it?
Yes and no, but the good news is it was insured, and so it's not a lot, but here's a check for $900.
That's not bad, Martha, $900. I was thinking about firing you, but now I'm not sure what to do.
Oh, I wasn't sure if I work for you or if maybe we're just friends.
TBD, Martha.
Is that a clip from the show?
Yes, it is. Oh. From your show, Baskets.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah. What do you see as the objective of the show?
I think the main thing was to try to do kind of a non-edgy show in a way that was kind of old-fashioned and innocent, that had some dramatic undertones, if you would, but interrupted with really surprising jokes that kind of come out of the blue that aren't expected. But it's a tricky thing to try to pull off, and even going into it, we knew it was hard. It's tricky, and the tone of it was everything. But I think Jonathan Kreisel, the director of it, got the tone that was in our heads. And also Andrew Bird did the music for it, and I think that also, you know, he helped set the tone, you know, through his whistling. He's such a good whistler. So I think we all were on board knowing what we wanted to do, but we also knew that it was a little bit risky to kind of roll out a show like this.
I mean, the jokes on the show, when you say big, absurd jokes,
not all of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like a crocodile runs across screen and, you know, eats one of the characters or something like that. Like, the jokes are jokey. It's just but they belong to the world. It's just that the world is
kind of lonely, and well, I mean,
quiet.
But we have a, you know, in one of the episodes, in the backdrop, there's Neil Diamond singing Easter in Bakersfield, which, because it was an Easter episode, you know, that doesn't exist on a regular type of show. You wouldn't get away with that. But I think we put those things in the show to let people know we're not going to shy away from, like, absurdity because of the drama, but sometimes trying to fit them together is tricky.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. I'm talking to the actor and comedian Zach Galifianakis, who co-created the new FX series, Baskets. Let's play a clip of Between Two Ferns, because you had the president on this weird web show. And, yeah, I mean, if folks haven't seen this or haven't seen Between Two Ferns, imagine Zach as the host of a talk show on something like a low-budget community television set. And pretty much no matter what it does, he makes the whole thing more unpleasant.
Where are you planning on building a presidential library, in Hawaii or your home country of Kenya? Because, I mean, both places seem like they would be...
Zach, that's a ridiculous question.
Well, you know, I mean, not to bring up the birth certificate thing, but you really never did really produce your real...
Where's your birth certificate? Why don't you show it to us right now?
I don't want to show anybody my birth certificate because it's embarrassing.
What's embarrassing about it?
My weight on it, it says that I was born 7 pounds, 800 ounces. You know what I would do if I were president, Mr. President? I would make same-sex divorce illegal, then see how bad they want it.
I think that's why you're not president. And that's a good thing.
You said if you had a son, you would not let him play football. What makes you think that he would want to play football? What if he was a nerd like you?
Do you think a woman like Michelle would marry a nerd? Why don't you ask her whether she thinks I'm a nerd?
Could I?
No, I'm not going to let her near you.
I remember that.
What do you remember the most about it?
The part I remember the most was just how he entered the room and then how he left the room. And it was just kind of such a daze. He's just cool, you know. He is what you think he is. And gracious to everybody in the room and make eye contact with everybody in the crew. And, you know, it's kind of this moment where you just, it's hard to believe that you're this stupid little show and the entity of the President of the United States are coming together for this weird message. It's just very, very strange that it happened, but it was fun. It was nice. He was really easy to work with. You know, we played freeze tag to loosen up before the another improv games.
Quick game of zip, zap, zap.
Yeah. We loosen our vocal cords together, you know, that kind of thing. You know, just that kind of,
sure.
Which is weird to do with the
tip
president.
Of the tongue, the teeth, and the lips.
We did, and we did that. We did a pyramid, two-man pyramid.
Oh, cool!
Yeah, that was his idea.
Were you on the bottom?
Yeah, but I think that was just for girth reasons.
Right.
Yeah.
You're a stable base.
Yeah, I'm a good, good base, good stock. My people, good stock.
Sure. Do you? I have a sincere question.
Yes.
Do you think that you being Southern and being a nice and polite man is part of your fascination with doing these characters who are so prickly and unpleasant?
No, but I just do those prickly and unpleasant ones because that's the only thing people want me to do. I could do other things, Jesse. I could, yeah, I mean, no,
but
I just,
you could have done anything. I think I you lean created
on, I think I, so. I think I lean on it a lot. You know, I think sometimes you have your things in comedy that you lean on, and sometimes you tend to lean on things too much, and then you got to watch that. You know, I don't want to lean on that too much. You want to grow and experience new things and hopefully have a long, career if that's what you're interested in. But that kind of stuff comes easy. I don't know why it does, but meanness it's so angers me that I think I needed to do something with it in my head creatively. And it's not an homage to meanness. It's a meanness is stupid. We were just talking about in the writer's room about do we glorify smoking in the show? I'm like, well, it's Chip. What about him smoking is glorify? He's an idiot. You know what I mean? So I see him as an idiot. That's kind of repulsive. But I want the audience to see that too. And I hope that they will like him enough in his repulsion that they will allow him to grow, because I think that's what he'll have to do.
Why do you think you want to spend time with a repulsive idiot?
As a character?
As a guy who created this show and has to write it and has to...
It's because... because it's funny, because it's easy and fun to play. There needs to be a message behind it. Just to do it on the coldness of being mean is not the intent. That to me is not good enough. It needs to have some kind of, not a lesson, none of that, but just some layer to it that is not just him spouting off his mouth because he's a frustrated human being. He needs to have his eyes open and see that what he does hurts people, maybe.
Is there some of the version of Zach Galifianakis that you play on Between Two Ferns, who is sort of, I don't know, like sort of disagreeable, unpleasant, and grumpy?
You mean the real me?
The talk show host that you as a person play,
right,
that shares your name.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is there some of that guy in Chip Baskets?
Yeah. When Louis C.K. asked me to start, if I would start thinking about doing a show, my original thought was it was going to be a behind the scenes of Between Two Ferns. And then I couldn't make that work, and people told me nobody would want to watch that. But that character is something that I wanted to bring. So, yes, there's elements of that for sure, of the anger, misplaced rage, if you will, which is a really funny thing. And I think I suffer from that in real life sometimes.
So I was thinking about the last time I interviewed you, which was actually quite a number of years ago now. Something almost like 8 or 10, something like that. And it was before you became a movie star. And it made me think about how odd and surprising and amazing it was when you became a movie star. I mean, I don't think even when you got a starring role in a movie, anyone had the expectation, oh, this is going to be when Zach Galifianakis becomes a movie star from here on out. You know, like,
is
the
that
hangover,
your way? Is that your way? That's your polite way of saying this will not last.
No, that's not. I couldn't have been more thrilled. I was like, wow, this guy I really like gets to star in movies. Like, this is fantastic. And I wonder what it was like for you. Like, I don't get the feeling that you know, doing The Hangover was part of a plan to become a movie star. Hmm. I may be wrong. you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what was it like for you when that movie became just a extravaganza whirlwind of, you know, show business power force?
Well, I wasn't good with it. I was – the privacy thing is the thing that just bummed me out. But, I would talk to my mom about it. She was like, well – you know, be careful what you wish for, Zach. I'm like, well, I didn't want success. No, I'm not saying that, but I never thought it was ever going to happen. Right. I never would go, man, when this thing really breaks, you better be ready. I mean, never. It's not going to happen, what was the mindset.
By the time you starred in The Hangover, you had a relatively big television show on VH1. That had not been a success. There was a lot of really funny stuff on it. It was artistic success, but not been a success for you. And that was kind of in the past. And it looked like, great, I'm going to be a successful stand-up comic, at least from the outside.
Well, that show tanked. And then I just went back to open mics because, show business doesn't owe you anything, you know, just because you keep working and you keep doing the thing the initial, you know, that love that you have for performing. Yeah, I just started doing stand-up again after that tanked, and then I got lucky. You know, Todd Phillips, the Hangover director, saw me perform at a club, and then he kept seeing me perform, and I didn't know that. He was just kind of showing up and seeing, and then he asked me an audition, and I did. But then when that happened, if you're not into that kind of world, that whole Hollywood scene, whatever that is, and it's not of any interest to you, and also you're older, and you kind of have more sense to you than be lost in that. It's a shallow existence, that kind of thing, I think. It can bum you out in a weird way. But no one cares, so it's great. You know, The Hangover was cast such a huge wide net to a huge audience that kind of thing can be jarring to a person, I think.
Especially because your character in the movie is so big and silly and
memorable.
Well,
people think you are that.
Yeah.
So they will sit down with you at a table at a restaurant because they think the character would like it. That's also a weird element to deal with because if people are sending you drinks and, you know, thinking they're going to be part of the party scene, which they saw you in the movie. Well, I don't drink anymore, and I'm a pretty normal guy. So, but that stuff doesn't happen anymore. That hangover stuff doesn't. That craziness has died down.
I mean, it seems like you've never not had some ambivalence about. I mean, I remember this is a long ago memory, but I feel like you told me a story that when you were on, you had a job for several years working on a dramatic TV show called True Calling.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I remember you telling me that that was like a long running show. And then when it ended, they made the announcement that the show was going to come to an end. And you applauded and then realized that that was not the right thing to do.
Well, I think what happened was the show was getting replaced by a show called The North Shore, which was some surfboarding show. But we still had 2 weeks worth of work to do. And it was 7 a.m. And the producer comes in and he has to make an announcement that, you know, everybody's going to lose their job. You know, everybody's out of work. And I was kind of in the back of my mind going, when is this thing going to get canceled? So he makes the announcement. I raise my hand. You know, there's 75 people in the room. It's 7 a.m. It's not the best time to be doing edgy material. And he goes, yes, Zach, what? Your hand's up? And I was like,
Yes, do you know the casting director to the North Shore?
And no one laughed. No one, and rightfully so, no one laughed. But again, it's not to draw, bring it back to the uncomfortableness or the jerk. I'm doing that to be a jerk, knowing that it's a jerk thing to do. But I'm taking a risk of people thinking that I'm just a jerk in that situation.
Well, I mean, it is a jerky thing to do, Zach. Whether or not it's,
but
I will stipulate to it being really funny.
But
you're also doing that joke before 75 people who just found out they're losing their.
But
job.
I'm losing my job too.
That's true.
And funny trumps other things. If it's funny enough, if it's funny enough, it can trump things. You'd be amazed what you could get away with.
I feel like that's a real comedian-specific point of view.
I can't tell you the specific times that that's been the case because I don't want to shine that light on myself, but yes. Is this NPR?
Yeah.
Can I tell you a story?
Yes.
Okay, so I was listening.
I love this setup.
I was listening to an NPR station in the backdrop. I'm not going to tell what it is. Mm-hmm. But they had a film review on of their summer movies, whatever. And I have one of the movies they were speaking of, I happen to be on. Now, I am not one to run towards good praise, bad praise, but this guy was talking about a movie I was in. I was like, I'm going to listen to this one. It was on NPR. One of the critics says, after reviewing the movie, let's hope this is the end of Zach Galifianakis' career. Then, oh, by the way, hold on, Jesse. I'm not even telling you the important part. I'm wearing a T-shirt of the radio station that I donated money to, and they're insulting me while I'm wearing the shirt. The other critic says, I hope you're right. There you are. Here's my $500 donation. Please send me a T-shirt. Please insult me while I'm wearing it. And by the way, public radio, if you're going to do stories on child labor in Bangladesh, don't have your NPR T-shirts made in Bangladesh. Thank you.
Zach, I'm really sorry that you had to find out this way.
Was it you?
About how we feel about you and your career.
Public radio across the board is what you're saying.
Oh, there's an annual conference called the Public Radio Program Directors, PRPD. And we actually had a keynote that was, what do we do about the Zach Galifianakis problem?
Okay. Well, at least it was. Okay, good. So it's organized. Okay, good. All right. Well, yeah, that was gut-wrenching. Only because I was wearing the T-shirt. Had I not been wearing the T-shirt, okay, no big deal.
Is your reaction to people receiving your work negatively to feel like, and this is something that I often feel, to feel like, oh, well, then what I would like to do is withdraw and narrow the band of people to whom I'm presenting my work until I can be confident that they will all like it.
Yes. That's a very good way of putting it. You just hope to put stuff out that people like. And then people, you know, why? But to be offended why people don't like it is also silly. It's very ego-driven, I think, to think, how, what? Well, yeah, we all have different experiences. If people don't like my humor, I get it. I don't like my humor. You know what I mean? Like, when people are like, that's stupid music. Yeah, there's stupid music. I think there's a lot of dumb music out there. But my point of view is different than somebody else's point of view. And we should all be okay with that. There's nothing worse than comedians getting mad at each other about what's funny and not funny. It's so boring.
I have friends, especially friends who are comics, who are used to engaging people who have a problem with them because they're stand-ups. And that's what you have. That's what you sometimes have to do if you're up in front of a crowd and you've got to get them on your team. And those folks will engage people on Twitter in to go to extraordinary lengths engaging these people. And I just find myself thinking, like, God, that doesn't make you just make you feel awful all the time.
And who has the time? I mean, to do it. The
stand-up comics.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
It is I forget. There's a lot of time.
They don't have to get into makeup or whatever, you know. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good way of expressing, I guess. I just haven't gotten into the whole, I'm out of the loop with that stuff.
I'll continue my conversation with Zach Galifianakis after a break. We'll talk about why the creators of Baskets thought Louis Anderson would be the perfect person to play his mom. P.S. They were totally right. He is. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Smith. Save time and money on your home improvement, remodeling, and repairs. Smith works to get you quotes from top-rated contractors in 24 hours. Contractors bid to complete your projects, anything from kitchen and bathroom remodeling to painting, plumbing, landscaping, cleaning, and much more. Get free quotes today by texting the word NPR to Smith. Message and data rates may apply. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. If you're looking for more shows to listen to, there's a great app for your phone called NPR One. It features hand-curated suggestions to help you find the best from public radio and beyond. News and podcasts, NPR One is ready when you are. NPR One is in your app store now. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Zach Galifianakis. He stars in the new FX series, Baskets. I want to play one more clip from Baskets. So my guest, Zach Galifianakis, plays both Chip Baskets and Chip's twin brother, Dale. And in this scene, Dale is helping their mom, who's played by the stand-up comic Louis Anderson, get ready for a family dinner. And they have two adopted twin brothers who are younger than them and are successful DJs. And they're going to be coming home, and so the mom wants everything to be perfect for their arrival.
Well, that's good. You got that. I got balloons, ribbons, glasses, plates. One more thing. We need a bigger table. See if you can get something at Rent-A-Room. You know, something in a chestnut, walnut, espresso. What's the black wood? Black walnut. Oh, that would be beautiful, black walnut.
I'm happy to help out, Mama, but why ain't this circus twerp out here doing anything?
Well, he's practicing. You can see that.
Well, Mama, your medulla oblongata must be squeaky clean because he has your brain so washed. It's a part of the brain.
Look, I watch your girls at the drop of a hat, and I don't know what your wife's telling them, but they don't like me.
Well, you can say what you want about my wife and I, but at least I gave you grandchildren.
Thank you, Dale. And don't forget to get something dark.
So, Zach, how do you manage the tone of you performing as your own twin brother with a Southern accent, a classic Bakersfield Southern accent, and the legendary stand-up comic Louis Anderson playing a woman without any notable elements of camp?
The idea of playing my twin brother was the director, Jonathan, wanted to be that to be a part of the show, one of the characters. I wasn't 100% sure that that was a good idea. But for the show, it was good because Chip is very quiet, and I wanted to play him quiet. And it's just nice to have a kind of a verbose twin brother that's opposite of Chip and kind of his nemesis in a weird way is a nice device in the show. And then the lack of camp as far as that character and also with the Louis Anderson is Louis is just hired as an actor. I mean, there was no, oh, wouldn't it be neat if we had a guy play a one? You know, there was nothing. It was just he popped in our minds because of the way he sounds. And it just seemed to make sense. And when we shot the pilot.
Did you know him personally?
Louis Anderson? No.
Yeah.
No, I just knew his work from The Feud.
Yeah, right.
I've always liked Louis' stuff and his, you know, that presence in the show made sense to me. But when we shot the pilot, they put him in makeup and they overwomaned him, if you will, in a stereotypical way. And that was not what we wanted to do. It was just like, he's an actor who happens to be playing a woman, and there should be no tongue-in-cheek anywhere, and that's just how we wanted to do it. It's an homage.
I interviewed a couple of years ago Rick Moranis. You know, when he was roughly at the height of his Hollywood success, he lost his wife and just moved to the East Coast to be with his family. And, you know, he worked once every other year or so on offers if they gave him $1 million just to keep, you know. And I wonder, as somebody who became successful and immediately bought a farm in North Carolina, that has appeal to you. And if it does, what is the thing that you think, you know, that has the power for you to keep you from doing that?
From just ghosting.
Just getting
Is this a request from NPR?
Yeah.
So they ask you to ask me through a question of if I could get out of the business. Jesse.
They didn't ask me to ask you that.
It's
literally a term in my contract.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
Well, right. They knew that I had talked to you once 8 years ago, and I had your email address.
You know, I've been haunted by the NPR cartel for years. Terry Gross.
Yeah.
Shirley Jihad.
Oh, absolutely. Have you ever had any trouble with a Fabia Quist-Arkton?
I don't know that name. Is that someone on the National?
She reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Huh. But to answer, and you can tell the jerks at NPR that the truthful answer is there's more to life than whatever you do for a living. There should be. And no matter what the profession is, unless you're married to your work, and that's lovely. But I have a friend that always, he says, whatever happened to that so-and-so? I'm like, well, maybe they just realized that the business is hard to keep doing it. And, you know, as a kid, you dream of being in it, and then you get into it, and you're like, oh, there's elements of this that are difficult.
So what's the part that you love enough to keep you doing it?
I mean, it sounds really corny, but I think that connection with from at least in stand-up, I know I don't think I could ever stop doing that connection with getting people to laugh. I know it sounds so base, but that to me, I think if you broke it all down, I get a real kick out of that. I just do. And I think I need it, whether that is doing stand-up. But with me, all I have to do is like fall down in a food court, Jesse. So I travel with it, you see. I don't need it in front of people in a microphone. I'm fine with a stranger, you know, with a big gulp cup laughing at me. I think that core of trying to entertain someone, not necessarily just making them laugh, but just to keep them entertained is something that I have in me. That it's not a burning thing, but it's something that I get a kick out of for sure.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It was really nice to get to see you, and I've really been so happy about all the successes that you've had.
Thank you, Jesse, and congratulations on the new digs.
Zach Galifianakis, he co-created and stars in the new FX show, Baskets. It airs Thursday nights at 10. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. When he was in his 20s, Michael K. Williams got cut in a fight, a razor blade to the face. He could have died. But the mark it left turned out to be his calling card. He'd been a dancer and a model, but the fight gave him the chance to reevaluate his life and to be reevaluated. He started acting seriously, and his first big role a few years later was the best character on the best television show ever, Omar on The Wire. He played another complicated gangster on another HBO show, Boardwalk Empire. His new series is called Hap and Leonard. It's about two friends in East Texas, one straight, white, liberal, and badass, one black, conservative, and gay, and badass. Here's a scene with Williams. He's out looking for a car that has $1 million in it. He's doing it with a guy that he really doesn't care for, whose name is Chubbs.
So Trudy says you're a gay. What's that like?
Let's try a version of this where you don't talk.
You don't act like any homosexuals that I know of.
You don't know any homosexuals.
I'm just saying it's just rare to meet someone who's so comfortable in their own skin. I mean, you're like the first gay black man I've ever met.
One more word. I'd be the last gay black man you ever met.
Michael K. Williams, welcome to Bullseye. It's so great to have you on the show.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
You were a club kid when you were a kid, right?
Yeah. I was the one with the loud floral shirt on and, you know, the high top fade. And, you know, he wore his suspenders backwards with these enormously gaudy looking shoes. I was that dude.
When did you start going to clubs? How old were you?
Oh, I was way underage, man. My first like adult club I went to, I had to be somewhere around 16 years old.
What kind of music were you dancing to?
I grew up liking music to dance to. You know, I liked the Bee Gees. I loved the Jackson 5. You know, I grew up with that Philly sound, that gambling huff, you know, that sound, that hustle music, you know, disco, whatever you want to call it. You know, I call it that feel-good music. You know, love is the message. And so I always gravitated towards up-tempo beats and you know, huge lyrics. And, you know, that kind of migrated to what we now know as house music, to my knowledge. So I kind of went that way, you know. And, yeah, that was my thing. That's why I homed in on my dance skills, actually.
When you were like a teenager and in your early 20s, like how many nights a week were you going out?
Oh, well, New York is and always has been a weekday kind of city. So, I mean, like Tuesdays, Thursdays, you know, you might find a hot spot on a Monday, you know, a Sunday. But like Friday and Saturday, we usually gave that to the, you know, as what we refer to as the bridge and tunnelers.
You didn't want to deal with that Jersey City nonsense.
Yeah, you know. Shout out to Jersey, Newark.
When did you think that, you know, dancing in a club could be more than just a thing you did a few nights a week for fun and could actually be a job?
Well, I think you're the first person that ever asked me that. One night, there was a Heather Hunter, the ex-porn star. She's a very good friend of mine. When I first met her, she was branching out into doing music, and she had a gig at this club in New York called the Sound Factory Bar. And in the 11th hour, her dancers backed out, and she was contracted, you know, to have us be on stage a certain amount of time with a certain you know level of stage performance. And she was freaking out. And she and I had a mutual friend in common. She called him. He called me. And I was like, wait a minute. Heather Hunter, the legendary porn star, wants to get me in my favorite club for free. Let me do what I love to do the most on a stage where I don't have to worry about nobody getting in my way. And I'm getting paid. I'm like, where do I sign up? And that was really, after that, I got bit by the bug. I loved it. Loved being on stage.
How old were you? I mean, what are we talking about?
26, 20, 25. Well, I got cut on my 25th birthday, and this was definitely after that. So I would have to be somewhere between 26, 27.
I want to play a song that came out when you were right around that age, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about what you remember about it and that time. This is Kim Sims and Too Blind to See It.
Wow.
So tell me about that, Michael.
I'm sorry. Give me a sec. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I was... man, excuse me. I saw him, man. That was the first time that, you know, like my dream came true, you know what I mean? Like, when Kim hired me to be a dancer, I was homeless, you know what I mean? I remember when I got the call. I was being kicked out. So while I was staying, they wanted me to leave. And I got the call that she wanted me to dance for. And I went to where I was staying. I was packing up my stuff, and I turned on the TV. And I remember that was the same night that Mike Jackson, he released a video for Remember the Time, you know what I mean? And he had got all the dancers from New York. And I remember seeing, like, Leslie Siegel and Josie and Stretch and all these young brothers and sisters that I looked up to and I aspired to be. Like, they was working with Michael Jackson. And I was like, one day I'm going to be there. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry. It's just, I haven't heard that song in a while. Just brought back a lot of memories, that's all. Pardon me.
Not at all. Was that the first...
That was my first dance job. That's the first time anybody ever hired me to do what I'm doing now. It was Kim Sims. That was my first job doing anything in this business. You know what I mean? Anything. You know what I mean? And so I'm here today on the strength of that one song. I mean, shout out to Kim Sims, man.
How'd you get the job?
You know what I mean? Through a mutual friend. She had a dancer who was already, her choreographer at the time, his brother from Brooklyn named Chad Brown, he was already working with her, right? And he had kind of recruited me to be like a standby, if you will, you know, like a for case him or his other dancer who he was taking out on the road to do her shows. And, you know, I met her through him, but I was the standby, the backup, the standby in case one of them couldn't make this show. So for like a couple of months, I was just learning her routines. You know, he was teaching me the routines, and, you know, just getting me ready in case we had to make the call, I could just go. And that was, you know, she gave my shot, man. The call came, Chad couldn't make a show, and he put me on, you know, I was up, gave my shot, and she ended up just keeping me, man.
When that happened, did you feel like a professional?
Yeah, you're damn right I did. I felt like a grown up. I felt like, you know, I felt like, damn, it's really possible to get paid doing something you love. You know, that wasn't a job. That was my first glimpse into my career, you know. Who'd have thunk it? Me from Brooklyn, from Flatbush, with a career. You know what I mean? That doesn't happen often.
You had done some kind of classic New York actor work earlier in your career, like being on Law and Order and stuff. But from what I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you weren't really working when you went out for Omar. Is that true?
Yes, sir. My mom's had a... my mom, thank God for her, man. Shout out to Lady P, man, Big Mama. My mother opened up a daycare in the projects where we lived, and she was able to offer me a job. So I took it, and I prided myself as her administrative assistant. You know, she was old school. She still had her ledger book and whatnot, and she wrote everything down. I said, it's 2000, we got to get this computers going on in here. So I did all of that for her, and, you know, with a lot of help, and, we implicated a free lunch program in the daycare. And I would say all that took up all of 2000 and kept me occupied. And for most of 2001, up until around October or so of 2001, I was sitting in my apartment. And how we do in the hood, you know, we put the TV on, but it's muted. You play music. And then, you know, it's either some spades, dominoes, you know, beer, weed, whatever going on. But chilling, wintertime. And, that was one of the things in my apartment, one of the nights in my crib. And I was there with Ruck, who just passed, man. Shout out to my brother Ruck, boot camp, man. He was there, me and him and my cousin. And the episode that I was on, Sopranos, came on TV. So I was like, okay, there's something wrong with this picture. I'm here on the television, and I'm here in the room. I said, what's happening here? It was like kind of like an out-of-body experience. And so I went to my mom. I said, look, I'm going to give this entertainment one more shot, right, Mom? I said, if it don't work, it's me and you, baby. We changing diapers, right? So I said, listen, she, what you need? I said, I need a loan. Give me 10 grand. She gave it to me. Reluctantly, but she gave it to me. And I put together this new, whole new reel, because it was the emancipation, you know what I mean? My emancipation, the comeback, you know what I mean? I'm back on the block. So I got a whole new reel, a whole new headshot. I bought a computer, because back in them days, it was before Apple. You had to go to the computer show at Queens Community College and build your computer. That's how we did it back in the day. And so, boom. And I put together this real gaudy package, and I put a hit list of 10 people who I was going to send this package to, like the reel, the headshot. I went, my homeboy, his mom's worked for Tiffany's, so I went and got all these Tiffany pens and Tiffany boxes, and I sprayed the tissue with Tiffany cologne, just going all out. And I mailed it to 10 people, Kedar, forget his last name right now, he's a music guy, Jimmy Roseman, a.k.a. Jimmy Hinchman, Shaquem Kapoor, Jackie Brown Carmen. These are some of the names that's on my list. I sent them out for Christmas presents, right? I said, you know what, Mike, it's Christmas. Let it marinate. I said, watch my clock. It's right around January 10th, 14th. I should be getting some calls like, oh, my God, we want to see you. Man, here we are in March. My mom's just beating on my door. Where's my money? I'm like, yeah, man, I kind of slipped into a darkness. I got a little depressed. This is, you know, post. I never really dealt with the 9/11 thing. I was having some stress issues with that and, you know, just being in the projects, you know, feeling unfulfilled. And I slipped into a little slight depression. And so, you know, that's where I was at when I got a call from Alexa Fogel. Thank God for her. She scoured the streets in New York to find me because apparently she did not see my awesome package. You know what I mean? But she found me.
You sent it to Kedar Massenburg, the guy that ran Motown Records.
I was desperate,
you were trying
man.
To be the next Erykah Badu.
Erykah Badu or D'Angelo somebody. Come get me. But, yeah, you know, Alexa Fogel found me. She found me in my despair. And she asked me to come meet this guy named Omar Devone Little.
It seems like it wasn't a particularly smooth journey the next 5-10 years of your career, though.
You know, I think I've been so fortunate and blessed. I think I've had a very, at the end of the day, I got nothing to complain about, nothing at all. You know, in the short amount of time I've been in this business, you know, especially you know, as an actor, the amount of success I've achieved, the level of people I've been blessed to work with and learn from has been truly like a dream come true. You know, I mean, got to remember, I only started acting. My first big job was The Wire. That was just 2002 we started. You know, I started on The Wire, you know, I'm talking with someone who never acted before, never had any dreams to act, never went to school to act, you know, and I got given this opportunity, you know, and grace of God, man, I was able to turn it into something, you know, that I could really, you know, do good with.
I'll finish my conversation with Michael K. Williams after a break. He'll tell us why he's so proud to have played Omar on The Wire. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Want a show that'll really take you somewhere? Check out a preview of NPR's newest podcast, Embedded. The show chooses a story from the news and goes deep. Learn about what it's like to be in the middle of El Salvador's gang war, or a biker in a Texas shootout, or a woman in the dude-heavy world of late-night comedy writing. Find Embedded now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hi, my name is Justin McElroy.
And I'm Dr. Sydney McElroy.
We host the medical history podcast Sawbones, a tour of all the weird, stupid, terrible, horrifying, hilarious ways that we've tried to fix people over the years.
If you haven't been listening to Sawbones, you've missed out on topics like
the seasick-proof saloon,
the woman who gave birth to bunnies,
the unkillable Phineas Gage,
the true story of Typhoid Mary,
polio.
And you can check out Sawbones every Wednesday by going to iTunes or wherever podcasts are sold.
They don't sell podcasts. I told you this.
or presented?
Offered for free. It's free. What better selling point could there be than that? Every Wednesday, MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are offered. It's Sawbones.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actor Michael K. Williams, who you might know from The Wire and Boardwalk Empire. He currently co-stars in the Sundance TV show Happen Leonard.
Did you have a point in your career where, especially working mostly as a dancer, you realized that you were going to have to figure something out because, you know, you started as a dancer as professionally in your mid-20s, which is already
which
on,
is late.
Yeah, which is already the,
on the
old
late side.
Side. Yeah. You know, there's not a lot of professional, especially, you know, street dancers or urban dancers into their 30s, you know?
Man, listen, shout out to the old heads, man. The old school brooms still know the corners. You know what I mean? Shout out to my old school dancers, man. My boogies. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's you know, when I knew I had to make a shift was, you know, when I started coming onto the scene, you know, I had the scar on my face, and I went from, you know, Mike Williams, who? Come on, dude with the scar on his face. Oh yeah. Yeah, I will admit I played that card for like about a whole 5 minutes, and that got real old hat to me. And I said, well, if I'm getting tired of being referred to as the guy with the scar, I said, it's going to be a matter of time before they start referring to me as the guy with the scar. I said, I'm in the building, but if I want to stay in the building, I need to bring some substance to this. And that's when I got blessed to be introduced to the underground off-Broadway world of New York City through my brother, Ray Thomas, again from Philly. He brought me to La Mama, and where I met Ellen Stewart, God bless the dead, and they put me in this play, and that's where I learned how to create character and layers and, you know, what is the method technique, what is the Meisner technique, and, you know, and then I got with my theater company, which I'm still with today, Theater for a New Generation, under Mel Williams' tutelage. When he put his hands on me, it was a wrap after that. I was going in these auditions, just knocking them down. And, you know, it was that gave me the substance and, you know, to let the scar go. It's not about my scar. I'm not here because of that, you know, today.
Was it scary to be as emotionally present and open as acting requires, or was that something that came comfortably to you?
Dude, you just played a pop house song, and I cried like a baby just now. I think we know the answer to that. I'm a marshmallow here. I can't run that fast. You know, but you know, that's where my strength lies. You know, is you know, being sensitive and vulnerable. You know, that's who I am. You know, and ironically, the more I allow myself to be that and to allow people to see that, is where my strength comes from, you know?
Well, let's hear a clip of you playing Omar on The Wire. Omar was a stick-up artist who stuck up drug dealers. And sort of universally, some combination of respected and feared in the neighborhood in which he lived, both because he had that code of only sticking up drug dealers and because he was the only person foolish / terrifying enough to go around sticking up drug dealers. Here he is in season two of the show, testifying in court, and he's just been sworn in.
State your name for the record.
Omar Devone Little.
Mr. Little, how old are you?
About 29, thereabout.
And where do you live?
No place in particular, ma'am.
You're homeless?
In the wind, so to speak.
And what is your occupation?
Occupation?
What exactly do you do for a living, Mr. Little?
I rip and run.
You?
I robs drug dealers.
And exactly how long has this been your occupation, Mr. Little?
Well, I don't know exactly. I venture to say maybe about 8 or 9 years.
Mr. Little, how does a man rob drug dealers for 8 or 9 years and live to tell about it?
Day to time, I suppose.
Shout out to David Simon, man. Nina Noble, Ed Burns.
This job was so important to you because it was such a breakthrough. I mean, it was the difference between you working for your mom in the daycare center changing diapers and you being a real professional actor making a living from being on screen. That must have really upped the stakes, you know, compared to some of the acting vets who could have felt confident that this would just lead to their next thing.
Yeah, I came on The Wire extremely excited and very, very passionate to do the best job that I can possibly do. And I was just so in awe of the people they had already had on the cast, you know, starting first with Wendell Pierce and Sonya Song. You know, I had just seen, I was like obsessed with her performance opposite Saul Williams in this movie called Slam. You know, so see her and, you know, Wood Harris, I was like, oh my God. You know what I mean? I bought my A game, my A plus game, actually. And I dug as hard as I could to find Omar. And I never stopped, like, you know, going deeper with him. It was always, I can go deeper. What other nuances can I find? What other layers can I add on? You know, it was always, I just attacked that like a dog that hadn't been fed in so long, you know what I mean? And I had a lot of support. That was truly an ensemble.
I want to play another great Omar scene from The Wire. So Omar and his boyfriend Brandon are on, they're part of this stick-up crew, and they're about to go meet up with another dude called Bailey. Who's in the crew in this scene. This is from the 5th episode of the 1st season. And they're packing up guns. And there's a little bit of profanity in this that we will bleep for the radio, but just, you know, be prepared, America.
Ain't like him to be late.
Bailey, you dope fiend. I'm telling you. People ain't to be relied on.
Hey, why you always got to talk like that, man?
What?
This and that.
I give it up. I lose half of what I mean to say.
Don't nobody want to hear them dirty words, man. Especially coming from such a beautiful mouth.
Wait for Bailey.
Early bird catch the worm, dog.
I heard that kiss wasn't in the script.
No, it was not. Yeah, there was a lot of newness on the set of The Wire. You know, a lot of, you know, first-timers like myself. And, you know, it was just so many characters and personalities and storylines to manage, you know, on a new show with minimal, you know, we had minimal dollars. They didn't roll out the red carpet for us over there in Baltimore on The Wire. So we had to make do, and there was no room for error. The directors that were coming would keep things kind of like, you know, just, you know, trying to just get through it, man, because there was so much to manage. And I was like, you know, I forget which episode I had. Just like, wait a minute. I said, okay, now I signed up to play a gay character, right? I know that I don't have to act feminine. I said, but, you know, I think it should be some more happening here. It should be like, we're doing a real show here, right? So we got to keep it popping. So I went to my co-star at the time, Michael. His name is also Michael, who played Brandon. And I was like, yo, Mike, I think we got to step it up, man. I said, all they got us doing is holding hands and rubbing lips and playing in your hair. I said, we got to, like, you know, saying, bring it. I said, you know what I mean? He says, what do you suggest we do? I said, yo, I think we should lock lips in this scene right here. He said, what? It's not this. I said, I know. I said, but I think we, you know, it'll really be, it feels right in this scene right now. He says, all right, when you gonna do it? And I started to tell him. He said, don't tell me, because I might freeze up when it's coming. Just pull in for it. Just go for it. I said, all right, I got you, right? I forgot, what's my man's name who was directing that episode. I'm getting old. Johnson.
Clark Johnson?
Clark Johnson was directing this particular episode. So he called us in for rehearsal. And, you know, he's like, yeah, run the lines. And he was still doing some, giving some direction, doing something with the lighting or the camera, whatever. And he heard the kiss. He turned around, looked at us. He said, whoa, stop the work. Said, run that scene again. Did it. Kissed again. He's like, he looked at me, read the script. He said, y'all put that in there? I said, yeah, we put that in there. Nodded his head. He said, brave. And I know from that point on, they started calling Michael K. Williams to the set no more. You know what I mean? I set the tone, set it up.
You know, there are a few characters that people are more fascinated by or identify with more on The Wire. And there are still not a lot of shows that treat the kind of situations and people that are on The Wire with the respect that The Wire did. And I think it really was, you know, it was really resonant for a lot of people for that reason. And so your character was the baddest of the bad on this show, and also really sweet and, touching character, and was also gay. And, you know, you were dancing to house music in 1988. I imagine that you were reasonably comfortable with the idea of there being lots of different kinds of gay guys. But when you were just walking home in Brooklyn or something and somebody came up to you and said, oh, man, are you Omar? It must have been a trip to connect with people who you were meeting that maybe didn't have that experience or weren't comfortable having that experience, for them to feel like they got to know Omar and that you get to have that exchange with them and almost be an ambassador. You know what I mean?
Wow, ambassador. That's ambassador. That's a strong word. But, I've been approached a few times and with warm words about breaking a certain stereotype of black gay men in Hollywood, or just gay men, period, in Hollywood, always being one way, which was feminine, or out, or, so obvious, whereas that's not the entire gay community. So, I got approached a few times and, got nodded, good looking, good portrayal of the character, but I would say my proudest moment of having anything to do with anything in that perspective was when I heard from Jay-Z's camp that allegedly my portrayal of Omar had given him some sort of courage, if you will, to come out publicly and speak for marriage equality. You know what I mean? And I thought that, he didn't have to put that out there. So I heard through his camp that that was part of his decision, included in part of his decision making to come publicly with that, and that humbled me a lot.
Some of the characters who are criminals and killers on The Wire are cold and sit comfortably under the heading of bad. A lot of them aren't, including Omar, who's a pretty murderous dude, but is immensely likable for many reasons. And I wonder if you knew, coming up in Brooklyn, people who were legit scary, people who got involved in bad stuff, who you also maybe liked.
No, I loved. I have a, Vanderveer. If anybody's from New York City of a certain age that ever heard of a little area in East Flatbush called Vanderveer, there's a few bad boys in that area, bad boy, I can say were my big brothers and comrades, which is who I pulled on to bring reality to that energy when Omar had to go menacing. I pulled from my relationships with these men growing up. But the hardest thing for me to do was to, how do I digest that and make it real for me? Because I had a certain because those same men who I speak of now from my neighborhood, they also knew how I knew who they were. They knew who I was, and everybody who grew up with me knew that Mike was so not that dude, you know. And so I had to find a way to make that believable coming from my vehicle. And for me, it was not the alpha male way to go. That wasn't going to work for my vehicle. It was his vulnerability. Like, you know, it's the dude that gets quiet and kind of like just gets real, like goes in. That's the one you need to be scared of, because they'll put that gun in your mouth while you're running it. You know what I mean? And pull the trigger and be done, you know, and never say a word. So that type of hostility and danger, it comes from a place of vulnerability, I believe. You know, it's when you hurt someone to the point that's sensitive, you know, and they could be dangerous, you got a very bad problem. And so that's why I played Omar from, because I could identify with his sensitiveness and in his vulnerability. You know, that's what I have in common with him. And I just took it a step further, because I know what it is to be angry enough to want to do malice to someone, but I don't act on it. Whereas in Omar, I got to go all the way there. And then you mix it with what I've seen, how dudes get who really get it in, how they go, and you mix the two together, it became believable for me. And I believe that's what resonated with the audience. The fact that I didn't want Omar to be a chest beater. You know, he was the guy like, all right, I see you. That's how you rolling. That's how you feel. All right, okay. Man, a few words, actions, you know.
I want to play a clip from another clip from Happ and Leonard, which is my guest Michael K. Williams' new show on Sundance. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, it's about these two best friends who are like not exactly detectives, but just kind of stuff happens around them. So Michael plays a guy named Leonard. His best friend is named Happ. He's played by James Purefoy. And they kind of get involved in this scheme run by Happ's ex-wife, who's played by Christina Hendricks. And she comes and sort of seduces Happ and convinces them that they should go try and find this underwater car that maybe has $1 million in it that's by an old bridge. Leonard doesn't trust her. He's just a bit iffy about the whole thing. And in this scene, he's agreed to do it, and they're loading up their car, or their truck, actually, to head out there. So let's take a listen.
We don't know this house for nothing.
No, he's a hippie idealist. He's going to take that money from a big, bad capitalist bank and give it to a good cause.
What cause?
Save the seals, save the whales. I didn't ask.
I get any money out of this?
The only cause I'm going to give it to is me. Seals ain't got no bills to pay.
How close is this Howard and Trudy anyway?
I don't know. I don't care. I told you. Just getting laid. That's all.
Boy, you keep telling yourself that. I don't know how I let you talk me into these things.
No. Rumor has it something to do with my perky ass. Perky ass.
Oh. I only said that to annoy Trudy.
You being alive annoys Trudy.
Happy Leonard.
The two of you are so wonderful together. And, you know, it's sort of the premise of the whole show. In a way, it's like a sitcom, not in that it's full of jokes, although it does have some jokes in it, in that it is just super driven by this character relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it feels so real because it is. You know, as you may or may not know, James Purefoy and I have known each other since, 2008. We were together working on a project in Cape Town, South Africa back then, for like 7-8 months. So, you know, we developed a friendship, man, kept in contact over the years. And so, and we talk like that, me, him, and his wife, man, we'll get together. It's just like anything goes, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's like family. So there was not a better fit for the role of Happ than James. I can't think of another person.
We're just about out of time, Michael, but I want to ask you about one slightly frivolous thing. So you and a couple of your co-stars from The Wire are in one of my favorite music videos for one of my favorite songs ever, cool, which is What We Do by Freeway.
you know, dude, you're shocking me today. You just keep coming with these like little, who are you, dude? You all over the place. I got a lot of respect for you, man. That's dope.
I know that when that song came out, I was a fan of The Wire, and seeing that video, you know, on like on 106 in Park or something like that, it was like, oh man, other people watch The Wire. Like, this whole time I thought it was just me, but it turns out it's me and maybe Jay-Z and Freeway and Beanie Siegel.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I realized that people were actually watching this show. I was going in the city to meet a friend of mine, and I had the radio on at Hot 97, and you know, it was Friday mix, you know, hip hop, and what's the one the dude from the G Unit camp? I think it was Yayo, Tony Yayo. He was spitting live on the radio, and the dude said, "I jump out the car with the Ruger on fire." Something, 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 like Omar on the Wire. When I tell you I heard that, I almost crashed on the Brooklyn Bridge. I was like, yo, yo. Man, oh, yeah. I was like, okay, I guess people are watching. Yeah.
Well, Michael K. Williams, I sure appreciate you coming on Bullseye. You're welcome here at any time. It was just a pleasure.
Thank you, man.
Michael K. Williams is one of the stars of the brand new Sundance series, Happen Leonard, which is just a lot of fun. It is a really great show, and he's great on it. Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
Every week, we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. The Gravediggers were a rap group dedicated to death. They were a super group, really. Prince Paul, the RZA, Fruquan, and Poetic. For the purposes of the group, they changed their names to The Undertaker, The Gatekeeper, The Resurrector, and The Grim Reaper. In the early 90s, when gangster rap was cresting, they didn't rap about killing. They rapped about death as a metaphor. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't get dark. Here's Poetic, a.k.a. The Grim Reaper.
I force my teeth on a gospel track. I'm not an apostle, but I bring the axe to your back. I chew and attack like crest on plaque. After that, your world is black. You drop into a hole. Your mold separates from your soul. Behold, the grave niggas told you beware, but you didn't listen. So now we appear.
The Gravediggers were obsessed with the resurrection of the mentally dead. Sometimes they were scary, sometimes funny, sometimes beautiful. Their first single, 1-800-SUICIDE, is basically a list of absurdly intense ways to end your life. Or, as the Gravediggers saw it, end your ignorance.
Hey, you little rich kid, what's your beef? Come and tell the Grim Reaper all of your grief. You ask for a bin, then you only got a cheat. Your pops got in, but yo, he's mad cheap. Maybe you're a bastard child, you think. Mom and dad are white and your dog is ink. Maybe you're Sicilian with a 10, but you hate lasagna and the pizza man. Now you stand on the grave digger lot. You're singing the blues about the rough life you got. Not, you don't wanna live no more. I guess you're really ready for the graveyard tour. When you get home, just seal up your windows and your doors. Turn the oven on high for about 4 hours. Light you a blunt, kiss your ass goodbye. You gasp yourself, cause it's a suicide.
By the time the early 2000s rolled around, a second album had been less successful than the first. Honestly, the first wasn't that huge. Prince Paul and the RZA had left the group. Things had been dormant for half a decade. And there had been one huge change. In 1999, Poetic, the Grim Reaper, was diagnosed with cancer. The doctor said he had 3 months to live. He fought hard. It bought him a few years. But Poetic must have thought some of that time about how this metaphor he'd played with the Gravediggers, was becoming terrifyingly real. His last verse on record is one of the few hip-hop songs that's moved me to tears. You hear a lot about death as an abstract in songs, but death wasn't abstract to Poetic. It was present and absolute. The verse is from a song called One Life, and it's a clear-eyed embrace of the simple physical pain of dying and of the terror that comes with not knowing what'll happen after your last breath. In a genre that usually prefers mythology to reality, it's almost too real. Paralyzed on the bathroom floor by pain. Last month I endured, but now I can't ignore. Feels like railroad spikes being stuck in my liver. Am I dying? Eyes crying, body starting to shiver. Crawl upstairs from the basement, calling my sister. Dawn, help me, I ain't feeling too healthy. Stomach walls burning, head spinning and turning. Waiting for the EMS 3:10 in the morning. Rush me to emergency, screaming like a newborn. The pain's too strong, maybe my soul's trying to move on. They hooked me to the IV, put me through some x-rays. Gave me Demerol to kill the pain, that was the next phase. Early the next day in the hospital room. Moms and pops in the room, three or four docs in the room. Test results suggest your colon and your liver. It's so cancerous, you got 3 months left. Death is playing chess. Ever since then, my strength is the most high, my fam and close friends. The last F is set free, bless me with a verse. Staying healthy comes first, look at me, things could be worse. When I'm wrestling with the everyday, I sometimes find myself thinking of Poetic. Just trying to get up and get to the phone so he can call his sister. I think about his life, over at about my age now. And it strengthens my resolve to do what I can with what I have. Poetic, I never knew you, but I thank you. That's my outshot. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abadi and Exparello. Our production assistant is Christian Duenas. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music is provided to us by Dan Wally. Thank you, Dan. And thanks to the Go team and to their label, Memphis Industries, for providing our theme music. Thanks this week to Neil Rauch at NPR New York for engineering help. Ever the stalwart friend of Bullseye. Thank you, Neil. If you like our show, please rate us on iTunes. Those ratings help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. And if you want to chat or ask a question, you can find links to our email, Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, as well as to all of our past shows on our website, MaximumFun.org. Guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, who believes that plants and gardening are for everyone. With over 25 years of developing, trialing, and testing some of the most recognized flowering shrubs and evergreens on the market, Proven Winners Color Choice makes it easy to transform dull yards into vibrant, colorful landscapes. Ready to spruce up your yard this spring? Proven Winners Color Choice created the Gardening Simplified Landscape Guide to help you get started with tried and true elements of good planting design. Identify the roles you want new plants to play in your outdoor space, like ground covers, climbers, or attracting pollinators. Then browse garden plans and see which layouts and plants can bring your vision to life. Proven Winners Color Choice shrubs are available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide. Learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.